Aku menjadi hari. Jaya Gopi Chandavallabha. Jaya Gopi Chandavallabha, Jaya Giridhara Dhari, Jaya Giridhara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana, Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana, Yamuna Tira Banachari. Yamuna Tira Banachari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunjabi Hari. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Jaya Gauranitai, Jaya Gauranitai, Gauranitai, Jaya Gauranitai, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Tinamine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pashatya Deshatarine Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Garatara Shri Vasadi Gaurabhaktavinda. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo
bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Narayanam namaskritya Naram chaiva narottamam Devim sarasvatim vyasam Tato jaya mudirayat Nashta praishu apadreshu Nityam bhagavata sevaya Bhagavati uttama shloke Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. Before reciting the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is our very means of conquest, one should offer respectful obeisances unto Narayan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, unto Narayan Rishi, the Supermost Human, unto Mother Saraswati, the Goddess of Learning, and unto Srila Vyasadeva, the author, by regular attendance and classes on the Bhagavatam, and by rendering of service to the pure devotee. All that is troublesome to the heart is destroyed almost to nil, and loving devotional service unto the Supreme Person, who is praised with transcendental songs, is established as an irrevocable fact. So today we are reading text Canto 1, Chapter 7, The Son of Drona Punished is the title of the chapter. And the shloka are 13 and 14. Oh, okay. It's not at the top. Okay. I think you have to move.
You want to recite that all two?
I guess I can recite two and then one. You can each recite like the first one. You have to just move it down one line because you're missing a line at the top. So I think this is the right melody for this amount of syllables. Yadamrite Kaurava Srinjayanam
Yadamrite Kaurava Srinjayanam
Vireshato Viragatim Gatishu
Vireshato Viragatim Gatishu
Vriko Dara Vitagadam Vimarsham
Vriko Dara Vitagadam Vimarsham
Bhagno Bhagno Rudande Dhritarashtra Putre
Bhagno Rudande Dhritarashtra Putre
Bhartu Priyam Drownir Ittisma Pashyan
Bhartu Priyam Drownir Ittisma Pashyan
Krishna Sutanam Swapatam Shiramsi
Krishna Sutanam Swapatam Shiramsi
Upaharad Vipriyam Evatasya Chugupsitam karma vigarhayanti So I guess if you would all chant the first one. Go ahead.
That's the
Krishna Sutanam Swapatam Shiramsi Yada, when. Mride, in the battlefield. Kaurava, the party of Dhritarashtra. Srinjayanam, of the party of the Pandavas. Virishu, of the warriors. Ato, thus. Viragatim, the destination deserved by the warriors. Gateshu, being obtained. Brikodara, Bhima, the second Pandava. Avidha, beaten, got out by the club. Abhimarsha, lamenting. Bhagna, broken. Urudande, spinal cord. Dhritarashtra Putre, the son of King Dhritarashtra, Bhartu of the Master, Priyam, pleasing, Droni, the son of Dronacharya, Iti, thus, Sma, shall be, Pashyan, seeing, Krishna, Draupadi, Sutanam, of the sons, Swapatam, while sleeping, Shiramsi, heads, Upaharat, delivered as a prize, Vipriyam, unpleasing, Eva, like, Tasya, his, Jagupsitam, most heinous karma act vigarhayanti, disapproving. When the respective warriors of both camps, namely the Kauravas and the Pandavas, were killed on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and the dead warriors obtained their deserved destinations, and when the son of Dhritarashtra fell down lamenting, his spine broken, being beaten by the club of Bhimasen, the son of Dronacharya, Ashwatthama, beheaded the five sleeping sons of Draupadi and delivered the heads as a prize to his master, foolishly thinking that he would be pleased. Duryodhana, however, disapproved of the heinous act, and he was not pleased in the least. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Transcendental topics of the activities of Lord Sri Krishna in the Srimad Bhagavatam begin from the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra, where the Lord himself spoke about himself in the Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, both the Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam are transcendental topics of Lord Krishna. The Gita is Krishna Katha, or topics of Krishna, because it is spoken by the Lord. And the Bhagavatam is also Krishna Katha, because it is spoken about the Lord. Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wanted everyone to be informed of both Krishna Kathas by his order. Lord Krishna Chaitanya is Krishna himself in the garb of a devotee of Krishna, and therefore, the versions of both Lord Krishna and Sri Krishna Chaitanya are identical. Lord Chaitanya desired that all who are born in India seriously understand such Krishna kathas, and then after full realization, preach the transcendental message to everyone in all parts of the world. That will bring about the desired peace and prosperity of the stricken world. Om Jnana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Umlitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Panchakalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. I'm requesting the blessings of the Vaishnavas, and especially the senior Vaishnavas who may be listening today, that I can say something useful, bring us a little bit closer to Krishna just for today. So here now we are starting the narrations of the actual pastimes of the Bhagavatam. Right now it's been a sort of a prelude describing the background of how the Bhagavatam came to be. And as we heard, Vyasadev, he sat in meditation and he realized the whole Srimad Bhagavatam through meditation. And then he imparted it to his son Shukadev. And Shukadev, in turn, imparted it to Parikshit Maharaj in 7 days. And in the audience of when the Bhagavatam was being spoken from Shukadev to Parikshit, there was an assembly of sages, and Suta Goswami was in that assembly. And then Suta Goswami goes back to the sages of Naimisharanya, and he relates the pastimes to the sages of Naimisharanya, headed by Shanaka Rishi. So here, Suta Goswami is speaking to the sages of Naimisharanya, and here is now the first pastime of the Bhagavatam, which is entitled, The Son of Drona is Punished. And then this pastime will lead up to the birth of Maharaj Parikshit. And so then, you know, as we know, he becomes cursed and he's cursed to die. And he listens to the Bhagavatam for 7 days. And then he, after 7 days, he leaves his body. So this pastime, I thought what would be interesting is, so we're just starting the pastime. I thought I would just quickly give an overview of the pastime of how the son of Jonah was punished, and then perhaps speak about the topic of what happens in the shloka is that the sleeping sons of Mother Draupadi are killed. They're beheaded by the son of Dronacharya, by Ashwatthama. So I thought the rest of the class, we could talk about, you know, death, and you know how to put death in the proper Krishna conscious perspective. Since you can imagine how shocking that must have been for Mother Draupadi to have her 5 sleeping sons beheaded, you know, so sudden. And then later on in the chapters, Krishna actually pacifies Mother Draupadi and all the Pandavas and all the Kuru families who were suffering so much and lamenting because so many of their relatives had died in the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So I thought that would be the second part of the class. Kind of the majority of the class is discussing this. How do we become pacified, you know, within Krishna consciousness when we're faced with the death of somebody near and dear, or death in general? So this first pastime, when Ashwatthama beheads the sleeping sons of Mother Draupadi, and it's going to show how Ashwatthama receives the perfect punishment, which was advised from Krishna to Arjuna, because there were some conflicting factors in Ashwatthama's situations. And so there were some factors that indicated he should be spared and he should be shown mercy. And there are other factors that show that he should be killed. So we'll see how Krishna and Arjuna reconcile those two opposing proper punishments for Ashwatthama. So Ashwatthama's, so now it's said in the purport that we are at the beginning of the Bhagavatam right when the Battle of Kurukshetra ends. So here we are, the first shloka, and the Battle of Kurukshetra has ended. And Ashwatthama beheads the 5 sleeping sons of Draupadi, still in an enemy mode, because his impetus was to destroy all the Pandavas, including later we'll see, although he was punished, later he becomes offensive again and he tries to kill Maharaj Parikshit, who was still in the womb of Uttara. So his motivation is to just destroy all the Pandavas. Right, so that's why he beheaded the sleeping sons of Mother Draupadi. And then later, Parikshit, he wants to exterminate the Pandava line. Parikshit was the last in the line of the Pandavas, the only grandson. So just a couple of points. So Arjuna chases Ashwatthama, because Arjuna is married to Draupadi. And Ashwatthama releases a very deadly weapon called the Brahmastra. And the Brahmastra is like a nuclear weapon, but much worse. It has more heat and more radiation. And it's summoned by sound, by Vedic mantras. So it's summoned from the subtle platform. So therefore, it's much more powerful than a regular nuclear weapon. And also, it's a guided missile. So it can find its proper target. So in that way, the Brahmastra is more dangerous than the nuclear weapon. The Brahmastra can penetrate even the most protected place and would never miss the target. So Krishna here in this pastime, he advises Arjuna, and remember Krishna is the cousin of the Pandavas in this pastime, so he advises Arjuna to release a counter weapon to Ashwatthama's Brahmastra and then to withdraw both the Brahmastras and to arrest Arjuna, and to arrest Ashwatthama. So Arjuna does that, he arrests Ashwatthama, he retracts both the weapons, he arrests Ashwatthama, and then the debate begins as to what should be done. What is the proper punishment for the son of Dronacharya or Ashwatthama for having committed this most heinous act? So some of the conflicting factors in the consideration of whether he should be killed or spared, and again, this is all according to Shastra. On one hand, Ashwatthama was a Brahma Bandhu, so therefore he should not be killed. On the other hand, he was an aggressor, so therefore he should be killed. On the other hand, he was an aggressor without a weapon, and therefore he should not be killed. And Arjuna wanted to pacify his wife Draupadi, who out of great compassion and motherly feelings wanted to spare the life of Ashwatthama, even though he had killed her sons. She imagined how his mother will feel if he is also killed, so therefore, out of motherly compassion, Draupadi also wants to spare the life of Ashwatthama. Bhima, on the other hand, thought he should be killed because he committed murder, basically, and for murder, one should take the proper reaction. He should also be killed. And then Krishna also, Prabhupada says, for the sake of a test for Arjuna, he also sides with Bhima initially to say, yeah, Ashwatthama should also be killed. But here, Prabhupada says that he's testing Arjuna. Like, what will Arjuna do? What's the proper punishment in this case? So as it turns out, using his very sharp intelligence, Arjuna both kills and lets Ashwatthama live. He kills him in name by severing his hair and the jewel from his head, and he casts him out. So that is as good as killing somebody in that Vedic society, severing his hair, severing the jewel from his head and casting him out. So that was as good as cutting off his head, yet for all practical purposes, Ashwatthama will still live. So therefore, all the different opposing arguments for whether he should live or whether he should be spared, everybody was satisfied by this thoughtful action by Arjuna. Okay, so we'll see it. The other speakers will elaborate more on this pastime. I just gave you like a very high-level overview of what's going to come. So I thought we would now speak about the Krishna conscious perspective and Krishna conscious pacifying measures for death. As I said, how shocking that must have been from Mother Draupadi to have her five sons killed, beheaded. It's like the worst way to be killed, just sever their heads. And so what is the proper way to deal with death? And it says in the later chapters that thereafter the Pandavas, desiring to deliver water to the dead relatives who had desired it, went to the Ganges with Draupadi. The ladies walked in front. So they were doing their funeral rites for not only the sleeping sons of Draupadi who were killed, but also all the many, many relatives that were killed on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, the Kurus. And they were all related, right? They're all Kurus. The Pandavas and Kauravas, they're all related. So all of them were there, and it says that there sat the king of the Kurus, Maharaj Yudhishthir, along with his younger brothers and Dhritarashtra, Gandhari, Kunti, and Draupadi, and all were overwhelmed with grief. And Lord Krishna, the cousin, he was also there. So all of them were lamenting all the numerous and horrific deaths to all the relatives. And later we will hear, and then Krishna and the Munis, they have a very nice discourse where they pacify all the Kurus. And this is from 1:8, citing the stringent laws of the Almighty and their reactions upon living beings, Lord Sri Krishna and the Munis began to pacify those who were shocked and affected. So, citing the stringent laws of the Almighty, so we will hear how death is birth, death, old age, disease. They're all stringent laws of Krishna, and they are sort of perfect and inescapable. So, citing these stringent laws of the Almighty and their reactions upon living beings, Lord Sri Krishna and the Munis began to pacify those who were shocked and affected by the deaths. So here's very sort of suitable to say shocked and affected, because although death happens all the time, every day somebody dies, many people die every single day, every minute somebody dies in the world, but yet when it happens to somebody close to us, it is always shocking and overwhelming, right? So before we get to how Krishna and the Munis pacified the Kurus, and we'll get more into our philosophy and our pacifying measures for death. So before we get there, I wanted to just address a little bit about the darkness of ignorance that is in the world at large about death. Many people don't have proper information about what death is, and therefore it is something very fearful. And it is based on a darkness of ignorance. It's based on a lack of proper knowledge, a lack of this knowledge that we have here in Krishna consciousness about what death really is. Right, and in Bhagavad Gita 9:2, it said that this knowledge is the king of education, right? Raja Vidya, the king of education. Like, what is death? What is the point of us all being here? What is our true identity? Who are we? Right, Raja Vidya, the king of knowledge. And yet, all this knowledge, as Prabhupada always said, is not being taught in the universities. Right, they have departments for everything, but they don't have a department for the most fundamental and essential knowledge about who we are, what we're doing here, what is death, why do we have to die, right? So because this is not being taught in departments at universities, and perhaps it will be in the future, right? The only hope the people out there have is to meet the devotees and get the proper information. Of course, there are some disciplines out there that talk about death, and you know, they're not completely, not everyone is completely ignorant about death and dying, and they have some ideas of afterlife. But for the most part, there is no knowledge, and there's just darkness of ignorance, and there's many people who fear death, because they fear, of course, they will lose everything, and most importantly, they will lose their they will lose themselves, they will lose their identity, and of course, it will probably be painful, and I will be separated from everyone that I love. So these are all, you know, darkness of ignorance ideas that are out there. So that's why particularly it's our duty to disseminate this light of knowledge that, you know, explains everything, why we're here, what are we doing, what is death, what is karma. And so I was thinking, you know, because I came from that world out there, not that, I mean, I always thought about death ever since I was very small. It was just like foremost in my mind, like, death, we're going to die one day. But, you know, I did attend university, and I studied literature, as I mentioned here before. And this always bothered me that, you know, there was no information about death and what it's all about. And what I noticed was that there was a lot of theories out there, and not just theories, but bodies of art and bodies of literature. It's called existentialism. They try to address this very topic, like, what is it all about? You know, what are we doing here? Why do we have to die? So it's a whole genre of literature and art, existentialism, that talks about, it's trying to figure out. It's just basically, you know, knocking around within the darkness of ignorance and just coming up with, you know, ideas about it and just lamenting about it, basically. You know, it's very, maybe very beautiful and poetic and interesting, but it doesn't give any, you know, real answers. One, a very famous book within the existentialism, and you may have heard of it, it's called The Metamorphosis, and it's about a man written by Franz Kafka. You've probably heard of Kafka before. So the book is about, you know, just to show how absurd these ideas are out there about, you know, what's it all about. So, but it's a very, very interesting book, and if you don't have Krishna, it's quite, you know, fascinating and well written. It's called The Metamorphosis. And what happens is that the protagonist, he wakes up one morning and he discovers that he's been transformed into a giant bug. He doesn't know why or how, but he just wakes, he's a salesman, and he wakes up one morning and he's a giant bug. And I'll talk about, you know, what that means, but I'll just read you like the opening, so just, it's just kind of funny. One morning when Gregor Samsa woke from troubled dreams, he found himself transformed in his bed into a horrible vermin. Vermin is a bug. He lay on his armor-like back, and if he lifted his head a little, he could see his brown belly, slightly domed and divided by arches into stiff sections. The bedding was hardly able to cover it and seemed ready to slide off at any moment. His many legs, pitifully thin compared with the size of the rest of him, waved about helplessly as he looked. So what happens is that, so he's a bug, he's a giant bug, not a small bug, he's like a life-size bug. And he's living in an apartment with his family. And, you know, at first they're very compassionate to him. Nobody understands why it happened. They're very compassionate, and they try to take care of him. And they feed him bug food and, you know, lettuce, and they're trying to all cope with it. But eventually they get tired of him. Eventually he gets in their way, and they just grow tired of him, and they pretty much just, like, want to get rid of him, and they start ignoring him. And eventually, basically, he just dies from a lack of love and a lack of attention. And that's it, like, that's the book. So this is, you know, this is one statement of the human condition. So eventually, the giant bug, Gregor Samsa, he just dies of a lack of love and lack of attention. You know, so if you don't have Krishna, if you don't have Krishna consciousness, you could see how this could be, like, okay, this is it, you know, life is really weird and unhappy, and strange things happen. I don't know why, and eventually, you know, I just die. from a lack of love and attention. So it's a very famous book and very, very fascinating and well written. But if you have Krishna consciousness, you can see how, you know, absurd it is. And then also, of course, many of us have probably seen Woody Allen films or things like Woody Allen films where he's a neurotic character, right? He always plays the same exact character in his films, and he's neurotic, he's full of existential anxiety, he doesn't know why he's here, he doesn't know what life is all about, you know, what's it all about? And in one film, he actually goes shopping for a new religion because his religion doesn't talk about afterlife at all, so he wants to find out what it's all about. And in one film, he actually goes to meet the devotees. Do you remember that film? He meets the devotees, he goes to the Harinam party and he meets them and he speaks to them. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is actually in that film. And he gets books and he tries to talk to them. But unfortunately, you know, later on he's like, no way, you're never going to be a Krishna. And he throws the books in the garbage. So unfortunately, he was close to getting the answers, but he, you know, he didn't go for it. And then later on, he purchases a crucifix and a loaf of white bread and decides to be a Catholic.
I love
him. He was close to getting his answers and resolving all his anxiety, but he threw it in the garbage. So. All right, so before we get to our philosophy, wow, time sure goes really, really fast. And just because I think this is interesting, just to know like what's out there, early in the Christian tradition, there was something called the memento mori art form, memento mori, which means remember that you must die. It's in Latin, right? So it's early Christianity. And in many churches, they had various depictions of this idea of that everyone, you know, you'll have to die one day. And it was very prominent in the theology and in the people's minds. They all understood that they were going to have to die one day and probably very soon, you know, with things like the Black Plague, and their lifespans were much shorter than today. So in the pre-modern era, there was more awareness of death. And just some example of this memento mori tradition is, for example, Ash Wednesday, when the Catholics, they place ashes on your head with the words, remember that you are dust and unto dust you shall return. Of course, they have ideas about afterlife, so they do believe that we are the soul and we go on to live in the afterlife. So they don't just believe that the body dies and turns into ashes. But they do have awareness that the body is, you know, perishable and that this material body will end one day. And there's a couple of chapels, one in Rome and one in Portugal, that are actually created with human remains. If you go inside, there's bones. The inside of the walls are made with bones and skulls, like real skulls and real bones. And in the one in Portugal, there's an inscription, "We bones lying here await yours." Citing the stringent laws of the Almighty and their reactions upon living beings, Lord Sri Krishna and the Munis began to pacify those who were shocked and affected. The stringent laws of nature under the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead cannot be altered by any living entity. The living entities are eternally under the subjugation of the Almighty Lord. The Lord makes all the laws and orders, and these laws and orders are generally called dharma or religion. No one can create any religious formula. Bona fide religion is to abide by the orders of the Lord. So here what I'll say, basically, I'll keep reading, is that human life is basically meant for the preparation to die, right? In Vedic culture. Basically, that is the point of human life, and that is the best way to utilize this current human life, which is very fleeting and very short. So in that way, we can see it as a positive idea, right? This human life, maybe short, maybe fleeting, but if I engage myself in Krishna consciousness, it is a wonderful opportunity to elevate myself to a better position after death. As long as we are in the material world, our duty is to follow the orders of the Lord. And if by the grace of the Lord we are liberated from the clutches of the material world, then in our liberated stage also we can render transcendental loving service unto the Lord. In our material stage we can see neither ourselves nor the Lord for want of spiritual vision. But when we are liberated from material affection and are situated in our original spiritual form, we can see both ourselves and the Lord face to face. Mukti, so this is what we are striving for during our current lifespan. Mukti means to be reinstated in one's original spiritual status after giving up the material conception of life. Therefore, human life is specifically meant for qualifying ourselves for this spiritual liberty. And I'll just finish with, I have so much more, but I'll just finish due to time. I don't want to just rattle on. Very nice talk by Prabhupada, just a couple of paragraphs really quick, talking about how death is a changing of bodies only. So this was in Honolulu on January 1974. So the warriors, Prabhupada says that the warriors of Kurukshetra, their destinations were that they obtained their original swarup, right, because they were killed in the presence of Krishna. So they attained their original position. That was a part of the shloka. The warriors of Kurukshetra attained their destinations. Prabhupada says they all attain their swarup. So that is real success, Prabhupada says, to attain one swarup or original position. Prabhupada says, otherwise there is no death. Nahanya te hanyamane sharire, Bhagavad Gita 2:20. It is not death. When our body is destroyed, that does not mean we are dead. You are spirit soul, I am spirit soul, every one of us. But we have no death. That is another illusion. This is so-called death. It is not death. Dira, one who knows, one who is sober, he knows that. This man or this boy or this father is dying. He is not dying. Dehantara prapti. He is just changing another body. So actually, we have no death. The change of body. So we are accepting this change of body as death. That is another illusion. Dirastatrana muyati. One who is sober, he is not bewildered. He knows that. Suppose we are sitting here. We are sitting here, and after a few minutes, we shall go away. That does not mean that we are dead. We are in this apartment. We go to another apartment. Tata dehantara praptir. Bhagavad Gita 2:13. Similarly, nobody dies. It is change of body, from this body to another body. So we have no death. This is illusion. So what is your question? Prabhupada said that. What is the question? I don't understand. There's no death. Okay, so I'll just finish here and have a lot more, but see if there's any discussion points. Somebody? Anything that stood out for you in this class? Anything you want to expand upon or contribute? Divyanga Prabhu.
Thank you. I like the Woody Allen reference. I remember that movie Hannah and Nayana Biram. They were standing there in Harinam, and when Woody comes up to him, he hands him the Gita and a BTG. He goes, well, you know, here's, because he asked him, Woody asked him, well, what am I going to be? Can I come back to an aardvark? Or he's talking about reincarnation. And he gives him the books. And then, of course, later, he goes, nah, this is not for me.
Who are you kidding? You'll never be a Krishna.
But I do have a comment I wanted to make, because last night I watched Vaisheshikos Prabhu and his Sunday feast program, and at the end of it, they announced their scores for their pandemic sankirtan. And this has been done online. They distributed 250 sets of Bhagavatams and collected $180,000. This is when they're locked down. These devotees did it from their phones. So, I mean, it was really late last night because it's 3 hours different to San Francisco, but I was up there at 11 o'clock last night going, get out of here. How do you do that? And the advice was talking about is just purity is the force. And these devotees are really dedicated to this mission. And they prove that even in the weirdest circumstances, still, Prabhupada's books got distributed in a huge way.
It's probably people are a little more interested because they're suffering.
It's true. They might be thinking, hey,
they're suffering.
I don't want to die.
What's going on? I don't know what's going on. Yeah, thank you.
Oh, by the way. In college. Okay. In college, we read Kafka's work in German. I remember there was a discussion about the different perspectives of the family members when the person finally died. I asked, what about the person who was dying? What was his perspective? Also visited a church in Prague where the chandeliers were made of skulls and bones. Thank you for the nice class.
The chandeliers?
Well, that's some chandelier I don't want.
Yeah, we bones lying here await yours, is the inscription.
Yeah, waiting. It's just a matter of time.
From who?
Madhava.
From Madhava Prabhu? Mataji, you bring up a nice point when you say everyone becomes shocked and overwhelmed by the death of someone close. You mentioned you were going to discuss how Vaishnavas deal with death of relatives. Thank Krishna that the Lord has chosen to save us from the Woody Allens of the world. Who we once thought was a genius, right? Out there, Woody Allen is a genius, and Franz Kafka is also a genius. But actually, Krishna is the genius. His jokes were a cover for his deep-rooted atheism. Well, I don't know if atheism, but existential crisis. Well, how Vaishnavas deal with death? Well, I mean, I thought that I did address this because we have our philosophy, right? And of course there will be grief, and we should not just try to suppress our feelings and our emotions over the death of our relatives. I don't feel anything, I'm not this body, I'm just a change of the body. No, of course there will be grief, and there will be a period of time where there's grief and lamentation. But that grief has to be tempered with proper knowledge, right? The light of knowledge of what is going on. And to know that our relatives didn't actually die. They didn't die. They only disappeared from our vision, or they disappeared from our vicinity, but they didn't die. And there were so many instances, and I've also experienced this, where the dead relative comes to the person, right, in their whatever subtle body, spiritual body, who knows what their destinations were, but they come in their subtle bodies and they show you that I haven't died. So I think there's many instances like that, many books about like that, where relatives come. So we have to ultimately know that our relatives don't die. We get separated from them, and they go on their, we all go on our respective journeys. And with most of our relatives, we don't have spiritual connections in the spiritual world. We also have to understand, with some we do. We might be here with our eternal associates, but most of our relatives are not eternal associates. And we also have to understand they have their journey and we have our journey. So all those things combined help us to deal with the death of loved ones, and of course, if we need grief counseling, if we need to speak about our grief and receive therapy, of course we should all do that. It's not that we just become hardened and stoic and we just say, there's no death, no changing of the body, So we both, we apply the philosophy, we apply proper understanding, and we also find proper and effective means to deal with our grief for their departure from our current vision.
Can you read that, or is it too far?
Oh, it's too far.
Okay, I'll just read for you. This from Mother Bishulpia. The sadness of losing a loved one is central to us. Yet, the loved one is no longer upset or suffering. So for a devotee dying, it is different. He is looking forward to the next life, correct?
Yes, of course. Well, I had more. I was going to get to all that, but we just ran out of time. Yes, correct, actually. So one way that to deal with death, and this is personally like what I do often, is to have a grander vision of who we are and our life, and to understand that this current situation, this current like material life, is to see it as something like paltry and fleeting, and to understand that I'm a spirit soul and what awaits me is eternal life and immortality, and not just that, but in a place that's much better than Marchaloka, right? This planet of death. So we can sort of have a positive vision of dying. Actually, when I die, I'm hoping to go to the spiritual world eventually, and actually there, I'll be much happier. And I'll have my immortal body, I'll have my immortal self. I'll be there with my eternal associates, and I'll be there serving Krishna, and I'll be, you know, I'll have a body made of Sat Chit Ananda, you know, bliss, knowledge, and eternity. So, yes, for the devotee, we can have a very positive view of death. We should, you know, if we can come to that platform. I personally, it's something that I think about every day. I think about, I can't wait till I'm in my spiritual body. I just think about it every day. Okay, anything else?
There's a one question. I appreciated your class, however, is it our position to publicly disparage another religion and have laughing?
No, it is not our position, and I don't believe that I was disparaging any religion. In fact, I was not disparaging it at all. I was saying how in early Christianity, how they actually had awareness of death, and they had awareness of afterlife. So I'm sorry that you took it as a disparagement, but I was actually saying it as a positive thing, you know, because I also came from the Christian tradition, and you know, the talk of afterlife and the fleeting nature of this material life is very prominent in that theology. So I was not at all disparaging it, quite the opposite. You know, and I was glorifying how they do, they're very in touch with the idea that we're going to die and soon. So it was quite the opposite of disparaging.
I'm not sure what it means. Somebody wrote here, Momento Mori, a favorite gravestone slogan in Puritan America. Find it in old New England graveyard, all over up there.
Yes, the Memento Mori was also a tradition in Puritan America, right? I think that was the point. They also had, various other traditions also had Memento Moris, various Memento Moris. And I was going to ask people for examples from other traditions, what is a reminder of death. And did the person say the Puritan tradition? Yes, but the Puritans also had many, many memento moris, and they also had this idea of, abnegating the material existence. So that was very big in the Puritan tradition. So it's just understanding that this material existence is temporary and that we are living for something that is beyond this time and place.
Thank you.
Thank you. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.